Welcome back to Open Line. I'm Charlene Brown. A new documentary called Food Inc. raises a number of concerns about the safety and sustainability of the American food supply. We're going to be talking to the film's Oscar-winning producer, Elise Perlstein, and we'll talk to the issues faced by local farmers with Joe Logan of the Ohio Environmental Council and Renee Hunt of the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association. Thank you all for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. The film really is an eye-opener in many, many ways, looking behind the scenes at how our food is grown, produced, processed. What is it that you want people to take away from seeing that film, Renee?
I think the reality of where our food system is at right now, the images that we have about how our food is produced is still behind the bucolic farm scenery. And the reality is that it's been very concentrated with a huge amount of unintentional and intentional consequences.
And when you say intentional and unintentional consequences, what are you talking about?
There's environmental impacts. There's economic impacts, both to family farmers and to independent producers of all kinds. I'm losing my notes here.
Well, that's okay. Maybe Joe can jump in here and add to it as far as what it is that the film is trying to reveal about the way our food is produced.
Well, I think as Renee was pointing out there, Ohio agriculture and our national agricultural system has gone through an immense and alarming change in the last, oh, certainly 50 years. And as Renee pointed out, formerly and traditionally, we have our food system has been made up of local producers who have produced food outside of the communities, outside of the cities, and brought those into the inner cities and interchanged with folks at a centralized market or had a direct connection with consumers, but that is no longer the case. The circuit right now is very long and very circuitous, passing through some intense and enormous processing facilities that take food and take it apart into its elemental components and reconfigure it in ways that are a concern to those that are interested in human health, and frankly redistribute it in ways that is inequitable and in some ways unsafe.
And I would just also add crop biodiversity loss is a real big issue.
And what does biodiversity mean?
That we've really narrowed down the number of kinds of crops that we use, that we eat, as well as the number of species. And that sets us up in a real problem if there's a blight or an infestation for us to feed ourselves in the future.
And why would that be a problem, Renee?
Well, because we need genetic diversity, just like we need genetic diversity to survive. Let's remember, we're dealing with a biological system here. And so to follow the factory system, we're really promoting an unsustainable system. It's not healthy. We need diversity to keep our farms prosperous and growing. And you need all that interaction together. And one of the consequences of producing food just on volume is, and that's been the farmer's goal and the setup for farmers is that they're going to make their money off of volume. And what we're losing is nutrient density. We're understanding that we're producing more calories, but the nutrients available in those calories are not there.
And that is a result of reducing the biodiversity of the crops that we produce?
Yeah, and producing on volume.
Ah, okay. Elise, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Give us a brief summary of what this movie is about for you and what it is that you hope to accomplish by making it.
Okay, sure. And I just have to set the record straight. I have not won an Oscar yet. I've worked with a lot of Oscar-winning filmmakers, but so far I do not have a gold statue.
Okay.
Full disclosure here. But the film is, a pretty broad look at at our current food system, and it starts with the premise that our food has changed more in the last 50 years than probably the last 10,000. And it's changed in really radical ways, but ways that that are not really apparent to just the ordinary consumer walking through the supermarket. And we, you know, found that it's not apparent. That it's not an accident that we don't know, you know, that the food industry has really become consolidated in the hands of just a few companies, and those companies, for the most part, don't really seem to want to have a lot of transparency, and they want to kind of perpetuate the image that our food still comes from these small farms, as some of your other guests have said, and you know, you look at the packages and you see. You know, you don't see industrial farming operations on the packages. You see the image of the farm that I find in my kids' books.
Okay, so they portray a sense of nostalgia, but it's a very, very industrialized process.
Right. And you know, we set out actually to tell, you know, to just look at how our food gets to the table. We thought it would be a really interesting discussion because we do, on the one hand, have, we spend less of our paycheck on food now than we ever have, and on the outside that seems like a really, really good thing. We want to spend less money on food, but at the same time we're spending more on healthcare. And you know what we kind of conclude, you know, throughout the film is that there's a very high cost to this inexpensive food, and it's a cost that that you know we are bearing as a society, whether we know it or not.
Elise, in fact, you mentioned a half dozen or so major agribusiness corporations, and clearly they're presented in the film as the bad guys.
Well,
these are the companies, though, that make it possible for a lot of families, you know, to feed their kids every day.
Right?
Why would you want the public to have a sense that they're doing something bad for society?
Well, I wouldn't agree that we present them as the bad guys. I think what's really unfortunate is that that these companies didn't choose to participate in the film, and it's really difficult as a journalist or a filmmaker when you're trying to tell a story from many different points of view, and you know one whole side of that won't talk to you, and we reached out to you know all the companies that you see in the film that we note didn't participate, but many more as well, because we did feel that it would be, you know, interesting to address this question from lots of different points of view. So, you know, a lot of times we meet a grower or a farmer who is working with one of these particular companies, and we went to the company and said, this is what, you know, we've learned from this person A or B, you know, what's your side of it? There's got to be, you know, another side to this, and they just didn't want to participate.
And repeatedly in the film, you note that such and such company did not want to comment for this film.
Right. And, I mean, I personally find that really unfortunate because I think the public deserves to hear from these companies, and I think that might change. I think the companies might realize it's not really in their best interest to, you know, just to kind of back out of this discussion or bow out of this discussion.
The small farmers that are shown in the film are presented pretty much as the little guys who are being driven out by agribusiness. Renee, is that what you have seen happening here in Ohio, and to what extent?
Yeah, we, you know, part of the reason that our organization exists is because people 30 years ago said, we see what the industrial food complex paradigm is presenting, and it's not good for us farmers, so we need to do something else. But, you know, just for example, in 1974, we had more than 92,000 farms in Ohio. And, you know, in 2002, that dipped to less than 78,000 farms. So that's more than a 15% reduction.
And, Joe, what's your observation? How much do the large companies like Monsanto or Smithfield figure in agriculture here in Ohio?
Well, their impact is absolutely enormous. It impacts every farmer that's currently in production. If those very few farmers, let's take the crop of soybeans, it's certainly mentioned in the movie very prominently. Monsanto Corporation owns the patent under which 90% of those soybeans grown in all the farm fields across not only Ohio, but all our adjoining states and through most of the world. 90% of those soybeans are grown under a patent owned by the Monsanto Corporation. And I happen to personally know farmers who have had the Monsanto genetic police come to their farm and say, we believe that you have been cleaning and reusing seed that you have grown on your farm, and we're going to sue you for it. And they have absolutely carried through with that. And unfortunately, those farmers have all had to sign as part of the settlement agreement, an agreement not to talk about the issue publicly. But it's frankly alarming, the broadness of the thumb under which Monsanto has farmers in Ohio.
Joe, for those of us who are not familiar with farm processes, what is cleaning and reuse of seeds, and why is that a problem for Monsanto or for the small farmers doing it?
Well, it is a problem for small farmers only because Monsanto intervenes and say, no, since we made a small change in the genetic makeup of these seeds, we now own the ability to know how they are saved and used. And as I think most of your listeners are aware, farmers for millennia have saved their best seeds, their best performing seeds, and they've cleaned them and put them away so that they can use them as the genesis of the crop on the next crop year. This is a tried and true agricultural practice that has once again gone on. That is the basis of agricultural process for the last thousands of years. And nowadays, since Monsanto has been conferred these patent rights, and because Monsanto has decided to very aggressively pursue and protect those patent rights, farmers can no longer do that. They need to go out and plant a seed, and instead of keeping some of those seeds for the next year, they need to put all those seeds on the marketplace and go back the next year to Monsanto and pay the seeds. Not only do they have to buy the seeds and pay the price of the seeds, but they also have to pay Monsanto a technology fee, which over the last several years has grown to be a higher value than the value of the seed itself.
And can I just throw in, there's also just this chilling effect that corporations like Monsanto set when you have things like drift. If anybody has a garden, you'll see once in a while something will pop up that you know you didn't put there, whether it's a flower or a plant. Well, that happens when you're farming. And so if they find their GMO seeds in somebody else's field who might be organic and thus not having it, they will come down with their lawyers and sue these farmers, even if they are not responsible for those products ending up in their farm to begin with. It's very scary.
And the farmer can't just pluck that out and say, here, sorry, Monsanto, your seeds blew over here?
No, they're not that forgiving.
And we're talking about the process of pollination in which pollen can drift a matter of many miles in many cases. And so that genetically engineered pollen, if it arrives in another farmer's field who had a pristine non-GMO product grown in his field, that farmer is now liable for having usurped Monsanto's patents, according to many legal cases that have come down.
And actually, there's a farmer in the film, David Runyon, who had exactly this situation. He's never ever bought a Monsanto seed, and he grows conventional soybeans. He's one of the few in his area. Everywhere, every single one of his neighbors is growing genetically modified seeds. And he, had someone knock on his door late one night demanding to see his farm records. And, I mean, the point really is that the burden of proof is on this small farmer to prove that he didn't plant Monsanto seeds, even though he's never bought a Monsanto seed in his life. And this guy is, losing sleep at night, incurring legal fees, that's the story that this one individual went through. But we found everywhere we went, it was so difficult not only to get the corporations to speak, but to get these farmers to speak because they're terrified. And it's really, I'm not someone who grew up in a farm state or new farmers, but I am somebody who, believes that we have that we live in a country with freedom of speech. And it was really shocking for us to have such a hard time finding people who felt comfortable going on camera talking about how they grow food. We're not talking about nuclear weapons. We're talking about food.
Elise, can't the farmers buy seed from somewhere else if they wanted to use, organic seeds?
Of course they can. But what's happened, and again, this is the point we make in the film, is that increasingly the research dollars that go into the land-grant universities are not public dollars anymore. They're corporate dollars. So the research in the conventional seeds has kind of lagged behind, and the same farmer David says he showed us a list of from different seed companies of what seeds are available, and you know, pages and pages and pages of genetically modified varieties, and then there's like four that are not, and he was telling the seed cleaner in the film that he just bought the last bag of public variety soybeans available in his area. So even though, Monsanto will say, of course you can go buy other kinds of seeds, but the options are just so limited now.
The scale of the farms that are run by Monsanto or Purdue or Smithfield, again, are the reason that we have readily available, very inexpensive food. And you even feature a family in the film who chooses to buy fast food.
Well,
because
chooses,
it's,
I would challenge your use of the word choose, but okay.
Okay, they're buying their family fast food because they say they don't have the time to do any cooking because they're working all the time, and they go to the grocery store, and you show them bypassing things like broccoli or fresh beets because they cost too much. What is a family like that supposed to do? How are they supposed to feed their families if not with the mass-produced products that they can afford?
That's one of the biggest problems with our food system right now, that you know, because of a series of events over time, starting with Earl Butts, the former Secretary of Agriculture, who encouraged farmers to grow corn from fence post to fence post. Our food system now is skewed so that the processed food and soda and a hamburger is going to at a drive-thru is going to cost you less than a head of broccoli, and it's very, very challenging for a family like the one that we show in the film, because the father has diabetes and they spend a good portion of their income on medicine. So the mother says, what do I do? We've got to give him his medication so that he can stay healthy and continue to work, and so that he can provide for the family, and that cuts into their food budget. So it's really a terrible situation, and we filmed in this city just east of Los Angeles, where the rates of obesity and diabetes are skyrocketing, and I'll hear some critics saying, oh well, these people should just they should cook more, they should, it's their choice, they're responsible for their own situation, and I just kind of feel, how are they responsible when a head of broccoli costs twice or three times as much as a hamburger?
We're talking about the new documentary Food, Inc. The Drexel Theater in Bexley will present a special screening of the film tonight at 7:30. That's going to be followed by a panel discussion. It opens officially on Friday at the Drexel Theater in Bexley, but you can also go to the special screening tonight and you can chat with people that are on the panel and ask your questions. In the meantime, if you'd like to chat with us on this subject, you can give us a call at 292-8513 or send an email to openline@wosu.org. And Renee, there's another aspect of this that people should think about as well, right?
Right. Well, the reason why the food is cheap is because this model, this industrial food complex model, has externalized all the costs of production. If these facilities had to pay the true costs of their environmental damage to the rural communities, if they had to do the kinds of things to ensure that their food is safe, we wouldn't be able to, safe in the sense of the when you produce in such mass production, you're setting yourself up for E. coli and other bacterial problems on such a mass production process. So, you know, if these facilities had to pay their true costs, if corn wasn't subsidized to the level and farmers were rewarded for producing a commodity versus getting assistance for their specific farming practices that would help enhance the environment, help enhance food safety, those kind of things, we're really backwards. And so we're putting all our costs and externalizing them, and we're going to pay for it. We're seeing the damage now in the environment. We're seeing the damage on our health system. I mean, you know, I think the movie did a really good job outlining these issues and pointing out that, you know, one of two children are facing type 2 diabetes. That's really unhealthy.
And you say that goes back to the food supply, Elise? That the health effects of the foods we eat are, the film seems to suggest that that is because of what we're producing and how we're using it.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that was interesting when we were researching the film, it just seems like it's one of these situations of, you know, good intentions gone awry. and you know, you start out with a good idea. Oh, we can feed corn to cows, and that would be cheaper. But you know, each step of the way, when you look at how this system evolved, you see that we just kind of kept getting into a situation of something breaks, and then you fix the break, and we have a series of these broken fixes, but you don't really ever go back to the origin and say, well, maybe we're doing something wrong here. And I think some of the things that Renee, I agree with what Renee is saying, in the sense that that a lot of these the conditions under which this system operates are really kind of unsustainable. I mean, when you have to give antibiotics to all of the animals just so that they can continue to be raised that way, to me that raises a red flag. You know, why should we have to give antibiotics to all the animals just so they can survive? There's just something, you know, just gives you pause and makes you think, well, you know, on Joel Salatin's farm, the farmer that we meet in the film, everything kind of works in conjunction with each other, and he's not having to, you know, to medicate his animals just to keep them alive.
We're going to have to take a short break here, but when we come back, we'll continue our discussion of the new documentary, Food, Inc., a special showing tonight at the Drexel at 7:30. It opens for general public on Friday. You can join our discussion when we come back at 292-8513 or send email to openline@wosu.org. This is WOSU 820 Columbus.
Questions, political and judicial, abound this week, especially about the one question Judge Sotomayor couldn't answer. Senator Franken was horrified.
Didn't the White House prepare you for for that?
The one case Perry Mason didn't win? Too easy. I'm Neil Conan. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us with his own trivia question. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins later this afternoon. It starts at 2 o'clock, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line. Cloudy and rainy in downtown Columbus, currently 69 degrees at 10:30.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Metropolitan Club, presenting a variety of speakers on the relevant issues of today. More information is available at www.columbusmetroclub.org.
Time Team America goes deep into the trenches of America's most intriguing archaeological sites. Tonight, the team digs into the remains of the first American town founded by former slaves. Watch Time Team America tonight at 8 p.m. on WOSU-TV. And tonight at 8, President Barack Obama will hold a press conference that will focus on health care and the economy. Madeline Brand hosts NPR's coverage with Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving and Health Correspondent Julie Robner. Listen to live coverage tonight at 8, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line. We are talking about our food supply and concerns about it that are raised in the new documentary Food, Inc. That documentary, I have been corrected, has already opened at the Drexel Theater in Bexley. However, after the screening tonight at 7:30, following that screening, there will be a panel discussion about the film. So you can attend that and talk about some of the issues that are raised in the film, or you can give us a call right now at 292-8513 or send email to openline@wosu.org. And we do have some callers waiting to talk to us. This call is from Alex. Hello, Alex. Hi. You're on Open Line.
Hi, wonderful. I had to call and find out if the filmmaker, did they ever look into whether or not there's been a connection with the injection of steroids into the animals and the obesity problem that we're having now in America?
Elise, do you want to tackle that one?
Sure.
I'll take the answer off the line.
Okay, thank you, Alex.
Sure, bye-bye.
We didn't look at that exact connection. We definitely looked at the connection between, it was more of a environmental approach. Some of the research that we looked at, we found that in a city or a town that has more fast food restaurants than supermarkets, you're going to find higher rates of obesity and diabetes. So we were looking at more of the environmental aspects that lead to obesity and diabetes, and not that direct connection.
Joe, Renee mentioned something a few minutes ago that maybe you can expand on, too. The fact that we're growing fewer crops, we're growing enormous, enormous fields of one thing like corn or one crop, soybeans, does that set us up for potentially another Dust Bowl type of situation?
Well, actually, I do think that it opens windows of vulnerability. You know, back in the old days, I grew up on a farm myself that was a very diverse farm. I mean, we had poultry, we had hogs, we had dairy cattle, we had all manner of crops, and frankly, that sort of a system was extremely resilient. And farm families really went through a very tough time during the Depression and thereafter in a fairly easy fashion because of the resilient nature of that diversity of the crops that they were producing. If one crop was hard hit by a frost or a drought or a flood, another would do well. And without that diversity now in our system, relying on these very few types of crops and very small number of production templates, I think it does expose us and make it more vulnerable to all manner of things. And with climate change on the horizon, I think it's an issue we need to attend to.
And I would add that, you know, it's a very fossil fuel dependent system. So as we look at our eventual running out of fossil fuel, or fossil fuel getting so expensive that, you know, we're not going to be able to produce cheap food like this in the future.
And Renee, for those who are not familiar with farming practices, why is it so dependent on fossil fuels? What is it about the process that uses up all that fuel?
Well, there's the farming across the fields. There's creating the chemicals, the fertilizers, the synthetic fertilizers, and the pesticides. Those are all fossil fuel-based. And, you know, our food travels an average of 1,500 miles. So when you have a system set up where food is being shipped across country, it takes a lot of resources.
We have a caller on the line. Thank you, Renee. We have a caller on the line now. This is Lewis. Hello, Lewis. You're on Open Line.
Hi. Thank you for allowing me to call in and talk and comment. I haven't seen the show yet. I intend to, and I met one of your people there over at Bill's barbecue the other day, and we were talking about this thing. And so I've got to go out and see the movie, because today kids don't they couldn't have eaten the food from 50 years ago like I did when I was a kid, and today you get another effect. I'm sure this is not exactly what you all are talking about, but like you go into Kroger's and there's these huge, huge apples. They're beautiful, like they fell out of a Renaissance painting or something, and they're just, they have no taste. The texture is just, you eat this huge thing, and I just quit eating them because I just felt bloated, and there was no gratification, no satisfaction. It's just mundane food. Tomatoes are the same thing. They're very hard skin. The bananas are okay, but I've noticed they're difficult to peel. Like the peels have been toughened up on everything. I suppose it's so the machines can handle it instead of people, but the food is just so boring today.
Let's...
As advised. My point is that food, if it's not gratifying, I have a tendency to eat more of it, and that's going to make me fatter.
Uh-huh.
So I just don't buy that boring stuff. I try to go to the farmer's market where there's something a little bit different and has some taste to it and some texture.
Okay, Lewis, thank you for your comments. Let's have Elise address that, because in the film you actually do have a segment about that exact subject.
Right. Well, I think this is kind of what we talk about when we say the food still looks the same, but it's different. I mean, tomatoes are a great example because, you know, as Renee was just saying, a lot of times they're grown one place, shipped somewhere else, and in order to be able to survive that shipping and sit on the shelf longer, those tomatoes have been changed. They're bred differently, and they just don't taste the same. So, I think you really can tell the difference when you buy an apple or a tomato from the supermarket versus the local farmer's market.
Joe, can you comment on that as well? Because I suspect there are people who are growing things that would have a taste that our caller Lewis would remember, but things have changed.
Well, that is absolutely true. You know, as Renee and Elise have both mentioned, our food tends to travel very long distances today. The average 1,500 miles, I think, is a statistic that's been pretty often quoted. And because of that fact, then durability is one of the qualities that's selected for in most of the produce. That's not necessarily the case in a local production system, and that's why at your local farmer's market you're going to find breeds of tomatoes that are selected for taste and for other characteristics, for wholesomeness, for nutrition, by families that really cherish these things. And that's one of the reasons why, as one of the caller mentioned earlier, that you can find unique qualities at farmers markets and in local production systems that are not available in the commercial systems.
Elise, is one of your objectives to, I don't know, maybe convince everyone to be a vegetarian or to grow their food themselves?
No. We really we don't have an agenda, actually, except to try to bring these issues out into the public and get a really healthy debate going about it. Because, you know, one of the problems for us is that, you know, we feel that to make good decisions as a consumer, you have to have the information. I mean, that's kind of the cornerstone of our democracy. How can we vote, whether you're voting for with your fork or with your vote, if you don't have the information? And so it's you know, a lot of the information that we need to make good decisions is not available because of the way that the food is regulated and who's influencing those regulations. So, for instance, genetically modified foods don't have to be labeled. And now the statistic we found is that 70% of the processed food in a supermarket contains a genetically modified ingredient, and you don't know it because it's not labeled. So, and then you call the company and you try to find out if they know where they're sourcing their food, and the system's just so big, they you know, a lot of these companies said we cannot tell you exactly where this food is coming from, but it's very likely that it's genetically modified, the corn and soy. And also, we filmed a hearing in Sacramento, in California, about a bill that would require food from cloned animals to be labeled as cloned. And it seems kind of matter of fact. And the industry representative there said, "We feel that to label this food as cloned would create unnecessary fear in the consumer's mind." And we thought, well, you know, I personally, if I'm going to be eating food from a cloned animal, I'd like to know it. And you know, cigarettes have a warning label on them, or you know, they tell you what's in them. So if we're not given the information, then we can't really make good decisions. So the point of the film is, you know, let's create more transparency in the system so that we as consumers have the information to make decisions, whatever they are.
And you mentioned the tobacco industry. I suspect that experience, watching that whole process and finding out that, in fact, the tobacco companies knew that the effects that nicotine would have mm-hmm. and knew that their cigarettes could potentially be a health hazard, that has probably made some people skeptical about what any large corporation says to them. I suspect there are people who would wonder. But as long as there is silence, you don't even think to question some of these things.
Mm-hmm. There are certain parallels between the tobacco industry and this some of the food corporations. And I mean, you know, we really don't want to. We're not trying to say across the board all these corporations are bad or you know or dark. But it's just about access to the information. And if all of the you know if genetic modification is a wonderful thing, then why not tell us? Why not put it on the label?
Have you gotten any response to the film from any large corporation, any agribusiness?
We have Monsanto has a website that they created that you know challenges some of the points in the film and exactly some of the things that we were hoping they would say on camera, and we did pursue them for many, many months trying to get their participation in the film. Also, some of the meat and poultry associations came together to create their own response to the film. And in both of those cases, you know, it's just an interesting example of public communication because both Monsanto and these meat and poultry associations kind of attribute things to the film that are not in the film, and they're trying to portray the film in a particular light. So, but in some ways, I'm happy that they've done it because that's the kind of public dialogue that we're talking about that's healthy for all of us to have.
Okay, we have a call on the line from Jerome. Hello, Jerome. You're on Open Line. Do you have a question or a comment about the film, Food Inc., or about food production? Okay, looks like, all right, we've lost Jerome. If you have a question or a comment about how our food is produced, give us a call, 292-8513, or email openline@wosu.org. Joe, is there any sense that the large industrial farming businesses are likely to make changes in the way they produce our food, especially if the public starts asking more questions?
Well, as was pointed out in the film, there is a broad kind of citizens movement now toward more higher quality, organically produced products. And so, you know, the Walmarts of the world and every major retailer is now kind of becoming more attentive, more receptive to locally produced, higher quality niche items, and they're really placing those on their shelves and trying, you know, in some way to adapt to, acknowledge, and in some measure co-opt those movements among the public. So there is some attentiveness to that. But at the same time, I think obviously there is this insulation factor that Elise mentioned, that they have really refused to acknowledge. And I know that we got country of origin labeling adopted in the Farm Bill in 2002, but because of industry pressure, we could not actually get it enacted in any way, shape, or form until just this year in 2008, despite the fact that both houses of Congress had passed it and the president had signed it. But industry pressure is extremely strong, and they are not going to give up this without a major fight.
And what's really sad is that they hide behind the family farmer and say, you know, these large industrial operations should not be regulated like other industries because we're farmers. Well, if you're doing it at such a scale, you are creating waste. You are creating a huge impact. And they've really set themselves up to minimize the kind of regulations and accountability that they have. And at the same time, they're putting smaller independent farmers out of business. So who are they really helping?
That is the question that all of us need to ponder. And in fact, some of our callers may be pondering that. Jerome is back on the line. Hi, Jerome. You're on Open Line.
Hi there. Sorry about that earlier. I've made this point a couple times on Open Line. And I think it bears repeating in this context that my experience out here in Union County is that the farmer's market is not what people think of it. I think farmer's markets and a concern for good eating is largely an urban phenomena of a denser population of educated, more affluent people. The farmer's market out here in Union County is just dying. Competition isn't being promoted. There's really good producers out here, but they won't sell out here. They go and sell in the Worthington and the North Market and stuff. You can't even get them to sell it to you here. They say, you know, why bother? So, you know, rural America is not this idyllic place being trampled under by agribusiness necessarily. I don't think they've been necessarily duped. That, you know, they may have bought into it and believe in it as much as anyone else. So it's a complex thing out here, at least in Union County. That, you know, there's nothing really happening in terms of you know, large scale sustainable farming that reaches its way to the consumer here where it's being grown.
Okay, so the food is grown there and then taken somewhere else to be sold, and it leaves that community lacking the exact kinds of foods that we're saying are probably best for everyone to eat.
Exactly, and there you get into the issue of transportation. The high quality food is going to the market where they'll get a better price.
Okay, let's have our guest comment on that. Jerome, thank you so much for your call.
Well,
Renee?
I would agree with that, and I think that's kind of what this movie really points out. This movie, and there have been other movies that have addressed this issue of how our food system has changed and gotten away from the diversity in rural communities to offer that. And so that's why organizations like OFA is working to grow the number of farmers so that they are available, you know, and looking at opportunities, different marketing opportunities that people can access, such as people belonging to a community-supported agriculture farm where they actually get a weekly delivery of food.
And OFA is the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association?
Yes.
Okay.
You.
And, Joe, your comment on what Jerome had to say about the food being grown in a community and then shipped out to be sold somewhere else.
Yeah, well, certainly, as Renee mentioned, that dynamic does take place. And with rural communities, you're going to have a lot higher number of people that are going to be actually growing their own backyard gardens. And they're going to be having a small plot on their farm, and so the demand for those items is already satiated in many of those areas, and so the demand from, you know, those who do not have gardens is going to be much much less. And so, as Renee said, of course, those people that are producing the high quality products are going to, of course, be attentive to the market and are going to go where the demand is highest and where the return is highest.
And Elise, your comment on that?
Well, I think actually your other two guests are more knowledgeable about the rural dynamics. But, I mean, I thought one point that the call – maybe what I also heard caller saying was that maybe there's not as much you know, that we need to be careful not to kind of across the board portray farmers as being under the thumb of agribusiness, that farmers are a diverse population. And we actually are really trying to – get this film out to rural and farming communities, and not just have it play in urban areas. Because I think that engaging people in cities and in rural communities about the future of the food system is really important, particularly hearing from the people who are growing the food.
And certainly, seeing the film Food Inc. Literally gives you food for thought about the entire process and where things stand in food production. We have a call now from Ramona. Hello, Ramona. You're on Open Line.
Hi. They were talking about the genetically modified food.
And yes.
I noticed in the produce section the SKU number. I understand that the 9 means organic and the 4 is conventional, but I started seeing a 3 as the first number, and I'm not sure what that is.
Can any of our guests address that question? I'm really, personally, I'm not familiar with the SKU numbers. I never even thought to look for a number, which you would find if you were buying a sweater. There would be a number on the tag on that sweater, and it would indicate things about where it came from and what the item is and so on. I didn't realize there were also SKU numbers on the food, but are any of you familiar with the numbering system?
I'm not sure if it's technically called a SKU number.
Okay. But it's a number that gives you some information in code about that item.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with any, you know, the only differentiation that we can really do right now is if something's certified organic. So either it's going to have that USDA certified organic label with it, which I think there's like two extra numbers if you were buying organic bananas versus regular bananas. So I don't think there's anything further differentiating our food system other than signage where, you know, some markets are trying to showcase local foods in their grocery stores.
And the organics, normally wouldn't they have a tag on them of some sort, a little sticker that says either USDA, certified USDA organic or QAI, meaning Quality Assurance International?
Well, that's the certifying agency. And OFA's one of the certifying agencies in this country. There's probably about 50 private agencies across the U.S. So one is USDA. We all are certifying under the same rules through the National Organic Program. And so the other label that you might see an OFA label or a QAI or Oregon Tilth, et cetera.
All right. So there would be some indication that, yes, somebody has certified that this is an organic product. Joe, are you familiar with any numbering system for these things?
I am unfamiliar with any numbering system. As Renee mentioned, I think the more clear the communication, the better in terms of country of origin or manner of production.
All right. We're talking about the film Food, Inc. and the questions that it raises about our food production and the sustainability of our agriculture. If you have a question or a comment, you can call us at 292-8513 or send an email to openline@wosu.org. What do you want individuals to, at least to think about the kinds of food that are provided in our supermarkets? You show beautiful panoramas of all the food that's in the stores, but what do you want them to draw from those images?
I mean, I think I think that what we hope people will draw from, you know, the food in the supermarket is similar to the rest of the film. Just you know, be a kind of conscious shopper. There are labels on food. They don't tell us everything that we might want to know, but they do tell us some things. And I think it's just that process where all of a sudden, if you tap into this problem, you start to become aware. And you know, like you're the caller who's looking at the SKU numbers, we all might not know exactly what they mean, but she's looking and she's trying to get what information she can get. And I think that we need, you know, that right now we can educate ourselves about what information is available. And I think it's also when you go to the supermarket, I mean, I know now I ask the butcher if the ground beef in the package was ground in the back of the store or where it came from. And, you know, I have two little kids, and when we were filming with the mother in the film whose son died from eating a hamburger with E. coli, 0157H7 in it, my son was the same age, and I couldn't really feed him ground beef in the same way because I just, you know, I wanted to know where it came from. So I think that process of communicating, of letting your supermarket know that you care and that you have these questions, you know, immediately puts them on notice, and then will eventually put all the companies on notice that we do have these questions and we want this information.
Although sometimes, certainly I've had the experience of asking about a product, like where did this fruit come from, and the person that I'm talking to in the grocery store simply does not know.
Right, but that's, I think that's part of what we all need to find out, that there is a disconnect that we all have about where our food comes from. And, you know, but at the same time, there's a disconnect, and at the same time, I feel like there is a an interest in people, at least we've seen with the reception of this film and all of the different kinds of consumer movements that your other guests have been talking about. I feel like we do kind of want to know, and if the people in the supermarket don't have the answers, maybe they need to start having them.
And then we simply should pressure them to get that information for us?
Well, I think just asking the question is the first step, because if nobody's asking the questions, then how is the supermarket supposed to know that people even have the questions?
Okay. Joe, what do you think the effect of this film will be on the people who see it?
Well, I think this is a very profoundly informative film, and I think that it really satisfies a need and inserts itself in a vacuum about information about food. I think people have gradually, as food has become a more remote product and people are less familiar with how it's produced and where it comes from, there's this really hunger and thirst for knowledge and information about it. I think people seriously distrust a lot of the institutional and highly engineered, highly processed foods these days. And this, I think, movie begins to lift the veil and give people information that they really need to know to conduct their activity and their eating behavior in a more rational manner.
And Renee?
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And I think people should reintroduce themselves to their food sources, whether it's asking at the grocery store or, you know, a trip to the farmer's market and get to know the people who are actually growing your food. And, you know, looking at things like eating seasonally, considering efforts like that.
We have Ramona back on the line. Let's see what she has to say this time. Hi, Ramona.
Hi. I just went to www.magnut.com, and it's an article, Read the Numbers on Your Fruit. Okay, I might have been off on the three, but I have seen them starting with a three. It says, the sticker label on fruit, the numbers tell you how the fruit was grown. Conventionally grown fruit has four digits. Organically grown fruit has five and starts with a nine. Genetically engineered has five numbers and starts with an eight.
Okay.
So that gives us a little more information. So the eight is probably what we need to be looking for.
And where do you find the numbers on the fruit?
They're usually real little.
They're the ones that you type into the, if you have to put a product code.
Maybe it's not SKU. Maybe it's price code.
It's the product code.
The
okay.
Product code, yes.
All right. Ramona, thank you for researching that for us.
Yeah, so we want to watch out for anything that has an 8 on it. Now, for me, I guess we're at a loss still.
Okay. Ramona, okay. Thanks so much for your call.
Okay, thank you.
And we have probably time to get one more question in. This one is from a listener who says, is anybody keeping tabs on the amount of farmable land versus the population growth? Here in Dublin, almost all of the corn and soy fields have disappeared. Renee or Joe, can either one of you comment on that? Joe?
Yeah, that's certainly an issue nationally. We've kind of allowed our cities and suburbs to sprawl out into some very useful farmland, and that's a trend that really can't continue. We need, and you know, at the same time, we've to a large extent abandoned our city centers in most cities across the U.S. So that trend really needs to be addressed and needs to be reversed, because the offshoot of that is, you know, the nation of Brazil has twice as much arable land now available for clearing as we have for production currently. But what we don't want to be doing is taking down those forests that are providing a very useful climatic service for us right now and replacing them with corn and soy. That would be a disaster environmentally.
And Elise, we have about 1 minute left. Can you give us a final thought on the film and what it's about?
I think this has been a really interesting conversation. I just encourage people to see the film and have discussions with their friends. And you know, I've heard people say, bring someone who doesn't know to the film. I mean, we didn't try to make a film for people who already are kind of engaged in this issue. We tried to make a film that would be helpful for people who haven't thought about it.
Okay.
And
All right. We're going to have to stop there, but I want to thank all of my guests, Elise Pearlstein, co-producer of the documentary Food, Inc., Joe Logan of the Ohio Environmental Council, and Renee Hunt of the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association. Panel discussion tonight at the Drexel Theater after the 7:30 screening of Food, Inc. This is Open Line. I'm Charlene Brown, and this is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.